Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the program. I'm delighted to have with me today in the studio for Talking Books, Madeline Gera, who, to the community of art lovers, of course, in Malta, will need little introduction. However, I think a few words about her would be appropriate. Madeline studied painting and drawing with Joseph Ruffer, and then she did a BA in philosophy from the Faculty of Theology here at the University of Malta, and was awarded a long-term scholarship to study etching techniques at the Scuola Internazionale di Arte Grafica in Bisonte in Florence, Italy. She has taken part in several collective and personal exhibitions in Malta and overseas, and since 2002 she's been spending her time travelling between Florence, Italy and Malta studying portrait painting. Her paintings are to be found in various corporate and national contexts here in Malta, the Louis Farrugia & Son Holdings, at the BOV in Ashar, the MTA building in Valletta, at the Old University, the National Museum of Fine Arts, and also the Valletta Architecture Project building offices, as well as, of course, in various private collections in Malta, Switzerland, Germany, the UK, Hong Kong and Sweden. Welcome, Madeline.
Hi.
It has become customary for me to ask my guests about their earliest memories of the written word. Who or what influenced them? What were the books that inspired them when they were young? If indeed they were inspired at an early age, as some of my guests say, they didn't really catch on to reading until later on. What was your experience?
Well, I remember, you know, books were always part of our life when we were growing up. There were always plenty of books around the house for us, and my parents read and still do read very much. I think when I was very young, my earliest memories were enjoying Enid Blyton books. I also enjoyed Biggles very much. And then I was a great comic reader. It was like the Beezer, Beano, Princess Tina. And then eventually when I got a bit older, it was Jackie, when I was like a teenager.
Early teenager. Uh-huh.
I think those are my earliest recollections of reading.
I think a lot of my guests have been into comics in a big way. And I myself remember really, really enjoying them. A next door neighbour had not the large size comics, those sort of comic booklets, which an older daughter than myself had collected. And I can remember spending hours sitting on a floor in her attic, just devouring these books. And then as you grew up a bit, did you become a sort of omnivore of books, or did you go for something particular?
I think in my kind of main recollection, when I really started, you know, reading a lot, was like my pre-university days. I remember I'd spent 5 weeks in Palermo, and I was doing a lot of ink drawing then. And then for some reason, when I came back, a friend of mine had recommended reading Proust to me. I mean, it's the only thing you can do when you're in your early 20s, when you have lots of time on your hands.
Right.
And I did a series of ink drawings, you know, based on Proust's Swan in Love. So, you know, I remember being in Goldsar. I used to spend a lot of time with Norbert Attard at that time, so it was, you know, very sort of intense drawing, and I did, you know, all these illustrations or images, evoked from Proust's books, which eventually became an exhibition. And then, so there was a strong link with the, with the written word. This is before I studied with Joseph Briffer, the church painter. So I'd already had, you know, quite a lot of exposure to drawing from life and being, you know, exposed to representational painting. And then I kind of, you know, put that aside for a bit and started developing a more idiosyncratic style at that time. So I was looking a lot at medieval illustrations and Japanese prints and, you know, Arab calligraphy. So I was kind of going all over the place for these Proust drawings, you know, having lots of fun, you know, lots of dots, lots of hatching. And then, at university, when I was, an undergraduate,
That would have made you read. When you go to university, of course, then mm-hmm. you get the texts and philosophy, of course. Definitely, you'll have to start reading an awful lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. Get you really into the mood for reading.
Absolutely.
Or put you off sometimes, I suppose.
No. But one of the things I had done at that time was illustrate Father Peter Seracino's Inglot's book, Beginning Philosophy. And I used the image of two chameleons, you know, on top of each other, like a mirror reflection of each other. And I remember he was quite pleased with that. And, he was a subject of lots of, you know, I used to do a lot of caricatures and sketches of him even then. Sometimes even fill, you know, the whiteboard with images and big fan.
Rub them off before he came in the lecture room or leave them there?
No, I think I'd leave them there. They'd come in and nod at them, I remember, and stop the lecture.
Something I'm sure he would find very amusing. Most definitely.
And then, you know, I had suggested, you know, if I could, you know, submit a selection of drawings rather than a long essay. And, you know, he was very much in favour for that. This is at the end, after the end of the course. So I ended up drawing my, my long essay rather than write it.
Wonderful. That's the sort of thing he'd go for.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm, yeah. So that was very exciting. And then, you know, after my degree, I, a few years after, I had applied for a scholarship to go and study in Italy. And I was still very much, you know, linked to graphic arts. And I studied etching techniques and printing and...
In Florence.
In Florence, that's it.
Uh-huh. Wonderful.
And then I came back here.
Can't imagine anything nicer than studying etching in Florence.
Uh-huh. No,
it sounds like a dream.
Yes, the studios were extraordinary. And I mean, the presses we had were fantastic. And I remember, you know, buying a press as well, but it was no way the same as the kind of thing that I was used to, you know, working on over there.
Mm-hmm. So. The book that you've chosen to talk about, when I pinned you down to a particular book, was a book by Elizabeth Kostova, who is the author of The Historian, which listeners might well have heard of, because it was a debut novel, a vampire novel.
That's right.
Which made it to number one on the New York Times bestseller list and shot Kostova, of course, to fame as a writer. Uh-huh. The book that you are interested in, The Swan Thieves, came a little bit after that original novel. Perhaps you could just outline it. Of course, I had not read the book when you first mentioned it, and when I went to do the research for it, of course, I understood immediately why you were interested in it. So perhaps you could just outline a little bit what it's about, really.
Sure. Well, it's sort of set in 1999 in Washington, and it's kind of contexted in, you know, just after the Columbine massacre. And this is how the book starts. And basically, it's, you know, it starts off by this artist whose name is Robert Oliver. And he gets arrested or detained for, you know, attacking or wanting to attack a famous impressionist painting called The Swan Thieves by a painter called Beatrice Cleval. I mean, you know, these names are fictitious, but they're closely linked to the impressionist movement. And basically, I mean, he gets, you know, put into hospital and refuses to speak. So, you know, from, you know, his sort of hospital room, he comes into contact with Dr. Andrew Marlowe, who's a doctor, but also a very keen painter. And he's very intrigued by, you know, I mean, and, you know, the Robert Oliver is like, you know, a well-known, you know, celebrity. And, you know, it sort of begs the question, why would somebody who, you know, loves his work so much or loves painting so much want to destroy it? And but he doesn't get anything out of Robert Oliver, so except the sentence, "I did it for her." So the reader and Andrew Marlowe are kind of like, so who is she? You know, who is this person? So he, the psychiatrist kind of finds out that he was married, and, you know, he says so his first port of call will be his wife, who he eventually goes to see in South Carolina. So we drive down there, you know, lovely descriptions of sceneries, and we meet his, you know, Robert's estranged wife. And we sort of, you know, get this, she sort of paints this portrait of sort of love and betrayal and obsession, you know, and we get to understand the mind of, you know, this genius. And, you know, another secret emerges. I mean, Kate, by the way, is also a painter. And, you know, because she's a mother, you know, her whole painting life has had to stop, so to speak. But, you know, another secret emerges that, you know, Robert had, you know, an extramarital affair. And so, you know, our sleuth, travels down to find Mary, who's also another painter. It's all a book about painters, really.
And in fact, it's one of the troubling things is that it's not terribly ethical. It's not. I mean, a psychiatrist mm-hmm. doesn't normally go into that kind of sleuth work with a patient.
Absolutely.
So it's a bit strange, this idea that he justifies it, I suppose, because he needs to help him, and he finds that he thinks that this is going to help him. I suppose that's why he's able to do it.
Yes, I think she actually touches on this point, but I do believe the artist does give him permission to contact these people and to talk to them if they allow themselves to be interviewed, which they do. So there isn't that element of he's kind of transgressing his profession, mm-hmm. you know. Anyway, so he meets Mary as well, and the same pattern, you know, forms, you know, the same pattern of somebody, you know, who's a very loving person, very much involved with his work, but also quite obsessive. And then there's also the, you know, the idea of dilemmas, which I found very interesting in the book, you know, the dilemmas of being an artist and, you know, having a family and how that affects you. And these are all, you know, true issues.
Real problems.
They really are. And, I mean, and, you know, how, you know, Oliver kind of and his wife changed each other, you know, sometimes for the better and then sometimes very much for the worse. And this is always, you know, a reoccurring theme throughout the book. I mean, even Andrew Marlowe, I mean, his, you know, his ordered medical life. And, you know, his peace of mind is changed in his quest to try and help his patient. So it's like one chain reaction after another, you know.
The various influences mm-hmm. On him mm-hmm. as the protagonist. What about the connection with the female painter mm-hmm. in the book? That is... It's about, she's an impressionist
yes,
painter.
That's
so
right.
The impressionists are part of the protagonists or are amongst the protagonists of this, I might say, over 500 page book. So quite a doorstopper.
Uh-huh. So basically, I mean, you know, one thing I really liked about this book is that it goes back in time. And, you know, it goes back in time through a series of letters, which... Robert Oliver hangs on to, you know, even when he's in hospital. But he does allow the doctor to photocopy them. And, you know, they kind of bring 19th century Paris blazingly alive when the doctor starts reading them and when we start reading them too. And it's kind, they kind of reveal, you know, a passionate relationship between an impressionist painter, you know, and... a love story, you know. I mean, there's a lot of things. The theme of love is very strong in the book, like young love or first love and lost love as well. And there's also, like, the most important thing about these letters, that it reveals, you know, an act of treachery, which is really, you know, what we find out right at the end of the book, you know.
It doesn't reveal the end completely.
No, totally. Uh-huh. And this is the function of the letters, you know.
Yes, the idea of the letters. I was really fascinated by that because I think in many books, one has found that this basis of letters which are so evocative, the idea of somebody actually writing down what they feel, something that's going to remain there perhaps for generations and generations, as in this case. And perhaps we have now an even greater fascination with letters because we tend not to write letters anymore in the same way.
Exactly.
I'm quite keen on writing letters myself as a person, but I find that more and more, or rather less and less, I'm writing letters. There's sort of been reduced to cards rather than letters. It's getting less and less. And as a sort of way of expressing ourselves, it now has a fascination of the past.
Exactly. Yes, and it really does evoke the past. And even the way language is employed in the letter writing appears to be sort of stilted and a bit over former. So, you know, it evokes the 19th century. It doesn't evoke contemporary English. Does that make sense? So you know when you're reading that you're not reading something that's happening right now or in the recent past. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. And what I also enjoyed is that she kind of mentions music in it as well. Andrew Marlowe is a great admirer and fan of César Franck's, and he mentioned the violin concerto. And to tell you the truth, it kind of works on many levels. I thought the book does. It kind of works on an auditory level, a visual level, and a word level as well. So I thought that was...
In fact, the idea, in one review I seem to remember reading, the idea of a writer having to invent the character of an artist, and this particular reviewer thought it was a difficult task. But in a way, a writer is an artist, in inverted commas.
Yes, of course. I mean, yes, definitely. I mean, and I think all arts are. I mean, it is like... I mean, we're all kind of related to each other in one way or another. It's just that it's, Elizabeth Kostova is definitely a wordsmith, while, the character she's describing is a painter. And, I mean, I found him particularly intriguing because he's a certain type of American painter who I've met, I mean, he paints in a very representational classical way, and you can, this is very evident in the descriptions of the paintings and the paintings he likes as well. So he felt very familiar. And also, today we don't sort of tend to associate, the United States with, classical representational painting. I mean, when the United States comes, to light in the media, it's usually for other issues. However, I have to say that they, there are some really wonderful, painters in this stream of representational painting, and I can mention a few. I mean, there's like Michael Grimaldi or Kate Lehman and Jordan Sokol, who I've met as well, and many others. I mean, and they're all under the age of 40.
Hmm. And, so you found the picture of the artist as a convincing.
Yes, yes.
Description.
Definitely, yes. Mm-hmm. Very much so.
And in fact, we often refer to a writer as depicting a beautiful countryside in a way that a painter would do the same, but only obviously with words. And yes. You mentioned the beautiful descriptions of the countryside on the drive down to Carolina.
Yes, absolutely. And also the fact that it kind of goes from one continent to another. Like, I mean, she describes New York because, Robert and Kate were living in New York. And then, she describes Paris, 19th century Paris. And then, the coast of Normandy and Etretat, which was a great sort of focal point for all the Impressionists. They sort of go on outings to paint there. So it's a beautiful book, and especially seeing it from these angles, from today's point perspective and from the past as well, and how these two worlds kind of meet in a novel.
the Impressionists in that famous exhibition, I think, of 1835, I'm getting my dates right, they made this incredible impression, excuse the word, but they had this incredible effect on the general public. Obviously, the critics at the time panned them completely, and then after that, obviously, the rest is history. But they still, the Impressionism still has this amazing effect on people. It has. There have been other painting types, styles since the 1830s, but none has had the resonance that the Impressionists have had. What is it about Impressionism that people love so much?
I mean, it's very, their paintings are very painterly. I mean, they're visually rich to look at, even in terms of textures and paints. And also, I think, you know, what's interesting about the Impressionists, and what I love, and possibly what other people love too, is that they started to talk about everyday life. People walking in the park, you know, sort of quiet interiors, everyday subjects. While before, perhaps artists were more concerned with painting heroic themes or battle, you know, famous battles, which have their function too. However, you know, Impressionism opened up a more discreet world to us, you know, to the spectator and to the artist as well, you know.
And she, the artist, obviously in this book, is a female, female artist. Again, they don't at that time they don't seem to have had the recognition perhaps that they deserve. Now, obviously, female artists even in Malta, well, you're an artist yourself, are getting more space perhaps than they used to before. Do you feel that there are these female artists that still need to be discovered from that time?
From the Impressionist period? Well, I always feel that generally, for some reason, female artists tend to be more invisible to the general public than men. I mean, for example, a case in point would be, you know, in Florence. I mean, there are so many very good female painters, even in the Vasari corridor. Like Angelica Kaufmann, like Artemisia Gentileschi, and what's the other one called? I can't remember. Rosalba de Carriera. I mean, there are none. We never really get to hear about these people, you know. I mean, we've had Caravaggio, and then we've had some more Caravaggio, and now we have Caravaggio and Caravaggisti. It always tends to be, you know, these sort of, you know, heavyweights. However, there are these, and the same with the Impressionists, you know. We have our favourites. Of course, we love Monet, and, you know. But then, you know, there were female painters there as well who are, you know, extremely accomplished. Yeah. And we hear less of them, you know.
in the few minutes that we have remaining at our disposal in this program, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your own art and where you are now, and perhaps by way of an introduction, say that recently I've seen your portrait of Father Peter, which is now up in the council room at the University of Malta, and we always paint our former rectors, and he's now there, and I loved it, of course. I loved it. Was very much, it's very much him, very much him. So tell us something about that painting and about where you are at now.
Well, that painting kind of started, I remember, obviously, you know, phoning him up and making an appointment, and I basically, you know, took my, you know, portable easel over and you know, and a canvas, and I thought I'd work on a bozzetto and, you know, chat with him and see, you know, what he had in mind. And obviously, you know, I wanted to convey him as I know him, which is, as you know, as a lecturer and as a professor. And I remember he had, you know, ideas where he didn't want to be wearing his rectorial robes, but he wanted to be the, you know, teaching rector, so to speak. And so he wore what he usually, you know, likes to wear, his usual clothes, with his belt. And I enjoyed that. I thought it was really good and, you know, quite brave as well. So it started off, I remember making a study of his head, and he was standing on the, you know, my right, and he just chatted away about, you know, various things, and I, you know, started off with a few studies like that of him. And then the other things were, we were wondering whether to put in various aspects, like maybe clowns, and one time we were wondering if we should put a donkey in, Petra.
Right.
But then we opted just for the clown. Yes. Which is at the corner.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. And mm-hmm. it's beautifully placed mm. because it's reminiscent of those Tudor type, mm-hmm. The time of the Tudors, those paintings where they used to put these little things which were reminiscent of the person themselves. I think you did it really, really mm-hmm. beautifully there. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, your own painting in general?
My own painting in general is about portraits. I mean, I'm, you know, really sort of going for it. I mean, you know, some people like to paint landscape. I mean, for me, I mean, I have my portrait commissions as well, and, you know, a little bit of teaching as well. But, you know, my obsession is the human face and the human, you know, rendering the human person. I mean, you know, some people like to go out and paint landscapes or paint seascapes or paint boats. I mean, I just enjoy painting people.
Portraits are notoriously difficult to grasp. I think it's a very special painter that can get that sort of look. There are plenty of good painters that are not portrait painters.
I mean, I'm interested, obviously, you know, especially if it's a commission. It has to be, you know, usually the person who's commissioning the work is keen to see a resemblance. For me, it's like, I don't know, it's not the most important issue. I mean, it is, of course, even when I'm painting portraits for the sake of painting a portrait. But it's a kind of, I'm kind of looking for a reality which isn't just a superficial likeness, you know. I mean, there are artists, for example, a famous American artist whose work I really like. It's called Andrew Wyeth. And in his Helga series, he painted the same person, Helga, you know, for 15 years, you know, and he painted her again and again and again.
There's an obsession for you.
Oh, that's it, most definitely, most definitely.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very, very much, Madeline Gera, for coming to talk to us about The Swan Thieves, Elizabeth Kostova, and also a little bit about your own painting. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.